toward Staten or Waynesboro, which was a complete fantasy in the first place, was merely a feint in the direction of Confederate General Edward Johnson in the western mountains. And Milroy knew why it could not be anything but a feint. Jackson cannot move from Port Republic toward my advanced position without leaving Banks in his rear, which he will not do. That, of course, was exactly what Jackson was doing. By midday, the first train had arrived at Staten, creating an uproar in the streets as the electric news of Jackson's arrival spread throughout Augusta County. Jackson, worried that such a celebration would draw attention, ordered Ashby's men to seal off the town. No one was allowed in or out. Thus far, his plan was working. Various Union commands did not know where he was. Or, more accurately, federal sources reported him at many locations, including Waynesboro, Port Republic, Gordonsville, Harrisonburg, Staunton, and en route to Richmond. Even Richard Ewell did not know where he was. The other news Jackson received, to his undoubtedly pleasant surprise, was that Banks had withdrawn from Harrisonburg on May 4 and was moving back north again. Exactly why, Jackson did not yet know. By May 5, the trains had carried Jackson's entire army to Staunton, where they were joined by the command of General Edward Allegheny Johnson, a loud-voiced, bluff, popular old warhorse with a Mexican-American War eye injury that made one of his eyes wink continuously. He was a hard fighter, popular with his troops, and a man Jackson liked and admired. Jackson's army was also joined by 200 cadets from VMI, whom he had summoned north from Lexington. Their role would be, as Jackson explained to VMI Superintendent Francis H. Smith, limited to care of the prisoners and baggage trains, which would allow volunteers to go into battle who would otherwise be kept out. Jackson met Johnson on May 6, wearing for the first time a full uniform of Confederate gray. Until then, he had worn only his old mud-splattered blue major's uniform from VMI. He'd gotten a haircut, too. At dawn on May 7, the commands of Jackson and of General Edward Johnson, some 10,000 men, marched west and north into the mountains for the town of McDowell. What of Banks, who merely a week before had greatly outnumbered Jackson and threatened him with annihilation? That same day, May 7, he wrote Secretary of War Edwin Staunton from his camp at New Market to say, "Nothing important has occurred today." He noted blandly that Jackson's army, which he had characterized the day before as broken and demoralized, had somehow occupied Harrisonburg. It had done no such thing. But something important was definitely occurring, more or less right under Banks's nose. Jackson was moving against Milroy, in such force that Milroy that same day sent an urgent plea for help. "Enemy is pressing us. Must have aid," he wrote to his immediate superior, General Robert Schenck. "Cannot Blenker's force make a forced march, relieve you and myself? Cannot you join me? Ask Fremont to have Banks press in on the rear of Jackson." The Battle of McDowell, as it came to be known, was a small, fierce, bloody 4-hour firefight on a steep mountain slope that ended up being more equal and far more lethal than either side had expected it to be. It was fought because Jackson, moving invisibly and with remarkable speed, had succeeded in intercepting a smaller Union force under General Robert Milroy that had been preparing to advance against Staunton. Because Milroy's army was well in advance of the rest of Fremont's other divisions, which were scattered somewhere north of Franklin, Jackson, by arriving when he did, had achieved decisive numerical superiority. That was the idea: to strike at the enemy's weak points, prevent him from concentrating his forces. A similar plan at Kernstown had failed because of faulty intelligence. This time, Jackson had taken better care to find out what he was up against. In the late morning of May 8, having crossed several high, rugged mountain ridges, the bulk of Jackson's army, with General Johnson commanding the advance, ascended a long, flattened, ragged chunk of vertical land cut by steep hills and ravines, known as Bull Pasture Mountain. From its crest, the world seemed a simple place. Below them to the west was a river, and behind the river was a small village. And spread out neatly on the valley floor, as in a giant amphitheater, were 6 regiments belonging to Milroy, and 3 to General Robert Schenck, a courtly 4-term congressman from Ohio and former minister to Brazil, who also happened to be one of the nation's most accomplished poker players and would later be known as the father of British poker. He had just arrived that morning after a forced march triggered by Jackson's sudden appearance in Stanton. If Jackson had harbored any doubts about Union troop strength, the sight of the federal camps allayed them. Combined, the Union had about 4,000 men. Johnson took his force off the main road and laid them out in long defensive lines on a steep, mile-wide spur of Bull Pasture Mountain known as Sitlington's Hill. Jackson's plan, already in play, was to use his superiority in numbers to move a large force of infantry and artillery by night on a flanking march around the federal left. His engineers had already found a route that would allow them to strike the main road 5 miles west of McDowell. In that way, he would block the Union Army's retreat, envelop it, and destroy it. But Milroy, as Jackson would soon learn, was no Nathaniel Banks. The gray-haired, 46-year-old former lawyer and judge from Indiana was one of the more aggressive Union commanders in the East. He was fearless and even reckless. In the words of Robert Schenck, he was undaunted and impetuous, though rather uncalculating. He liked to fight and wanted, more than anything else, to bring Old Testament-style retribution to the South for the sin of slavery. He wanted to attack Jackson with the full Union force, but was overruled by Schenck, who nevertheless agreed to let him lead an attack that evening with a little over half their troops. They were not going for victory, just a temporary advantage. They would inflict a sharp, quick blow, and then, as Schenck put it, retire from his front before he had recovered from the surprise of such a movement. That was the idea, anyway. The plan was daring in the extreme, bordering on foolhardy. Both Union commanders understood that Jackson and Johnson had joined forces. Both understood that they were outnumbered, camped in an indefensible valley, and facing an entrenched Confederate force on top of a high ridge. They knew that they would have to attack straight up the side of a mountain. The one advantage they had was surprise. An attack under those conditions, and with such a desperate disadvantage, was the last thing Generals Johnson and Jackson expected. While the troops under Johnson's command dug in on top of Sitlington's Hill, Jackson ordered his staff to his headquarters at a local hotel for a meal and some rest. They were all eating about a half mile away when the Union attacked. An interesting parallel occurred a month before when at Shiloh in Tennessee, Ulysses Grant was surprised by an early morning Confederate assault while he was eating breakfast 9 miles downriver. Like Jackson, he had not believed the enemy would attack. At about 4:30 p.m., Milroy, having received an erroneous report that Jackson was moving artillery to the summit of Sitlington's Hill, which would have been disastrous for the Union troops, gave the order to advance. Up the hill the Federals came, courageously and in good order, toward the waiting Confederates. What happened next, in textbook terms, should have been a disaster for the Union. But in the Switzerland-like topography around the small village of McDowell, there were good reasons why it was not. Mounting the hill, Milroy's regiments, mostly Ohioans, engaged with Johnson's battle line. At first, the advantages seemed to be with the Confederates. They held the high ground and could duck behind the crest of the hill to reload. The Federals, meanwhile, had to struggle upward over steep terrain that offered little cover. But these advantages soon vanished. Facing west, against a clear blue sky, the rebels presented neatly silhouetted targets, while the Union troops below were obscured in deepening shadow. Nor did the Confederates have artillery to take advantage of their high ground. As Jackson explained later, the terrain was too steep to drag the cannons up, and even if they managed to do that, the guns could not easily be removed and thus would be subject to capture. A final advantage was that the slope was so steep that the Confederate riflemen shot consistently high. But the main disadvantage was the disparity in firepower. Union regiments were mostly equipped with Springfield rifled muskets. The Confederates all had smoothbores. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the plight of the 540-man 12th Georgia Regiment, which had taken a forward position in the center of the Confederate line. Facing them was the 75th Ohio. Both sides quickly discovered the gap in firepower, which meant that, along most of the 12th Georgia's line, soldiers had to hold their fire, while Ohio riflemen loaded and fired at will. "The Yankee scoundrels would not advance near enough," wrote a Georgia soldier. The mismatch was so severe that the right side of the Confederate line had to stand fire, without returning it, for from 1 to 2.5 hours. This problem of firepower, plus an unfortunate choice of position, a V-shaped formation dictated by a jutting piece of land that left them exposed to fire from two sides, meant that much of their regiment was simply shot to pieces. To their credit, they did not back down. Some of them, having run out of ammunition, lay flat on the ground, ready to fight with bayonets. They suffered for such courage. Over the course of 4 hours, until darkness fell, the Georgians sustained 182 casualties, fully 40% of the Confederate total. "I felt quite small in that fight," wrote Captain S. G. Pryor of the 12th in a letter to his wife after the battle. "When the musket balls and cannonballs was flying around me as thick as hail, and my best friends falling on both sides dead and mortally wounded, oh dear, it is impossible for me to express my feelings when the fight was over, and I saw what was done. The tears came then free. Oh, that I never could behold such a sight again, to think of it among civilized people, killing one another like beasts. One would think the supreme ruler would put a stop to it." Pushing their unique advantages, Milroy's Federals struck Johnson's brigade along the hill's crest with unexpected fury. Suddenly, it was a real fight. And it was General Johnson's, because Jackson had, in his words, entrusted him with the management of the troops engaged. Jackson's job was to command the reserves. While Johnson slugged it out with Milroy's attacking regiments, Jackson ordered 2 Virginia regiments to block the road that gave access to Sitlington's Hill from the main highway. And, seeing how hot the fight had become, he quickly summoned reinforcements. "The engagement had now not only become general along the entire line," wrote Jackson later, "but so intense that I ordered General Taliaferro to the support of General Johnson." As one of Taliaferro's men observed, Jackson was evidently in a bad humor. Jackson also called up the Stonewall Brigade, camped several miles in the rear. Thus did the Army of the Valley engage, as Taliaferro's Virginia regiments now advanced to the center of the line. After Johnson was wounded in the ankle, Taliaferro took over command of the battlefield. Though the 12th Georgia continued to sustain disproportionate casualties, sheer Confederate numbers began to take a toll. As night began to fall, Milroy's troops, exhausted and running out of ammunition, had no choice but to withdraw. Wrote Jackson, "Every attempt by front or flank movement to attain the crest of the hill, where our line was formed, was signally and effectually repulsed." At 10 p.m., Milroy took his men off the hill. At 12:30 a.m., fully understanding how much danger they were in from the now united Confederates, Union forces silently began their full retreat north into the mountainous country beyond. Jackson set off the following day, May 9, in pursuit, leaving his 200 VMI cadets in charge of prisoners and supplies, and under the command of Maggie's husband, John T.L. Preston, and his former boss, Francis H. Smith. Jackson also took care to send a team of engineers to fell trees, roll boulders, burn bridges, and otherwise block the mountain passes in the Alleghenies that might have allowed Schenck to join with Banks. The Union forces, marching well into dark each day, managed to reach Franklin on May 11. Jackson arrived a day later, having been slowed down when Schenck's forces set the forest on fire. There he found Schenck's and Milroy's forces drawn up in a dominating position on a large hill. Jackson, for whom Banks, not Fremont, was the principal target, convinced of the impracticability of capturing the defeated enemy, owing to the mountainous character of the country being favorable for a retreating army to make its escape, decided to withdraw. On May 13, after the Army had attended a Jackson-sponsored divine service to thank God for their victory, Jackson put his army back on the road to the valley. The goals? Unite with Ewell and destroy Banks. In conventional military terms, the Battle of McDowell was a tactical victory for the Union. Though Milroy and Schenck had fought with superior weaponry and with odd and unpredictable advantages provided by the battlefield itself, they had inflicted disproportionately large losses on the enemy while accomplishing their purpose of saving themselves by delaying Jackson's advance. Jackson lost 146 killed and 382 wounded, while the Federals lost 26 killed and 230 wounded. It was one of the rare examples in the war when the defending force suffered more than the attackers. But in all other ways, the field belonged to Jackson. He had won the battle, in fact, before it had ever been fought, by his valley-encompassing sleight of hand that had allowed him to evade a Union army and to place his own force in the field against a much smaller one. Jackson's great brilliance was maneuver, the chess-like movement of an army to the right place at just the right time. And McDowell was the most prominent early example of this. Union forces could surprise him, yes, and hit him, but they could never have held the town for more than a few hours. Milroy and Schenck were not only forced into a headlong retreat, but had to flee fully 40 miles up the valley of the South Fork of the Potomac, putting enormous distance between Union forces and Stanton, and thus fulfilling Jackson's primary goal. Protecting Stanton had been his original idea. He had also put distance between the individual armies of Banks and Fremont. And by fooling Banks into thinking he had left the valley, he had gotten the additional benefit of Banks's ordered withdrawal from Harrisonburg. On May 1, Stanton and the precious Virginia Central Railroad had been threatened by two Union armies. Now, a week later, those threats were gone. But the real value of McDowell was inspirational. Jackson's simple message on May 9, which he rewrote three times, shortening it from half a page to a single sentence, "God blessed our arms with victory at McDowell yesterday," landed in Richmond with the force of a punch. Nobody had ever heard of McDowell, and nobody could tell how decisive a win it was, or exactly what was at stake, but here, at last, was a Confederate victory. In a season that had seen disaster after disaster, including Forts Henry and Donelson, Roanoke Island, Port Royal, Shiloh, and New Orleans, and when the South was watching with growing despondency as McClellan's giant army began to crawl up the peninsula toward Richmond, this was worth something. The Southern press ran with it. "Who can doubt when Jackson speaks?" asked the Lynchburg Virginian. "Like a Christian hero as he is, he ascribes the victory to the Lord of hosts. Long live Jackson." Chapter 24, Hazards of Command. A little more than a year after Jackson and his bright-eyed cadets marched picturesquely down the hill at VMI and off to war, this was what it had come to. A desperately hard world of death and dismemberment and terrible sickness that killed you as surely as bullets. And marches through hip-deep, ice-encrusted mud into camps that were nothing more than fetid pools of muck. The victory at McDowell had been purchased with much blood and sweat. Jackson's men had marched great distances and traversed two mountain ranges, all without the faintest idea of where they were going or why. They had fought a battle that left the corpses of their close friends strewn on a mountainside and had returned with scarcely a break to their interminable marches. War, in Stonewall Jackson's army, was never going to be anything but a hard and desperate thing. There was no stasis, no easy living, no resting on laurels, no rest at all, in fact. Oddly, his footsore army, amid its cursing and grumbling, was starting to embrace this idea. If Jackson was not exactly likable, he was certainly a man you could follow. And in spite of his Delphic refusal to share information, he was at least predictable. You were going to march fast and far, and then you were going to fight. and you were lucky if you got lunch. This hardness and lack of ease carried into Jackson's own role as manager of his army as it campaigned from Kernstown to McDowell and beyond. Alone in the valley, nothing came easily. Command carried with it 1,000 headaches, which included the constant wrangling with the War Department and with commissaries and quartermasters over supplies, the endless petty infighting among officers, and Jackson's constant battles with Richmond over officer promotions. He bore this burden silently. In camp, he spent most of his time in his room, poring over maps and reports. "He is at times very chatty, but usually has but little to say," wrote his mapmaker Jedediah Hotchkiss, after Kernstown. "He stays to himself most of the time, eats very sparingly, does not drink tea or coffee, and eats scarcely any meat. And while he sometimes kept Ahab-like to his quarters, he pestered his staff at odd hours, too, with odd requests. Once at midnight came a quiet message from his office that he wanted to know the distance from Gordonsville to Orange Courthouse. 15 minutes later, he requested the same information in writing. "For a while, I was wont to wonder if the general ever slept," wrote Henry Kidd Douglas. "But I soon found out that he slept a great deal, often at odd times." For a man who was all about action and movement, he was remarkably withdrawn from the common society of his fellows, though always furiously busy. When he did speak, he was, as always, stingy with his opinions about anything at all, from the weather to his fellow officers and men. He held fast to his old Christian etiquette. "I never knew a man more guarded in his speech in reference to others," wrote Hotchkiss. "I do not remember to have ever heard him say aught in derogation of anyone at any time." That did not mean that he did not have opinions, and strong ones, about his generals and senior officers, and, in particular, about the man who commanded his prized Stonewall Brigade, Brigadier General Richard Brooke Garnett. Though Jackson had outwardly professed satisfaction with the results of the Battle of Kernstown, "time has shown that while the field is in possession of the enemy," he had written Anna, "the most essential fruits of the battle are ours." He remained quietly furious at Garnett for ordering the retreat. He was absolutely certain that if Garnett had not ordered the men back, the fight would have ended in darkness and stalemate. Though it is not precisely clear why, Jackson had never liked Garnett, a Tidewater aristocrat who had graduated 5 years before him at West Point. A story circulated through the frontier army that Garnett had left behind a bastard son by his 15-year-old Sioux mistress. Perhaps Jackson heard it. Handsome, likable, and popular with his men, Garnett had spent 20 years in the army, mostly on the western frontier. Jackson had complained to Secretary of War Judah Benjamin as early as December 1861 that Garnett lacked discipline, and had reprimanded his brigadier for allowing his exhausted, chilblained brigade to fall out in 18-degree weather to eat a meal. To Jackson, Garnett's actions at Kernstown merely fulfilled his own long-held suspicions. Though Jackson's religious feelings were every bit as fervent in wartime as they had been in Lexington, he prayed many times daily, distributed religious tracts, diligently organized worship services and imported preachers to preside over them, there was not a shred of Christian forgiveness in what he did next. On April 1, 9 days after the battle, he relieved Garnett of his command, placed him under arrest, and charged him with neglect of duty. The charge was spelled out in a series of specifications, the substance of which was that Garnett had been absent at several critical moments, had failed to push his regiments into battle, and most seriously, had given the order to fall back when he should have encouraged his command to hold its position. This last carried more than a hint of an accusation of cowardice. Even more remarkable than the act itself of arresting a general, Lee, by contrast, never arrested any of his generals or subordinates, was that there was scarcely any substance to the charges, as Jackson's regimental colonels would all later testify. Garnett had performed well, and even gallantly at Kernstown, under extremely adverse conditions. To remain on the field would have meant the destruction or surrender of the Valley Army. Jackson's reserve simply did not get there in time to save it. His reserve ammunition was sitting on wagons miles back on the Valley Pike. Garnett's order to withdraw was what saved the army. News of Garnett's arrest was received in the Stonewall Brigade with shock, anger, and sadness. According to Jackson's staffer, Henry Kidd Douglas, an admiring and sympathetic chronicler of his commander, not a single officer at any level thought Jackson was right. Douglas wrote later that the brigade's regret at the loss of General Garnett was so great and their anger at his removal so intense and universal that their conduct amounted to insubordination. Garnett's successor, General Charles S. Winder, was received in sulky and resentful silence. And for nearly 3 weeks, General Jackson was permitted to ride past his old command without hearing a shout. Garnett himself was appalled, not just at the unfairness of the charges, but at the threat they posed to his career and reputation. "The charge and specification preferred against me by General Jackson contain matters of the gravest import to me," he wrote a friend, "as they would, if established, blast my character both as a soldier and a man. You can readily appreciate my anxiety to have as speedy a trial as possible, for by no other means could I be fully vindicated." As it happened, he never would be vindicated. Though both Jackson and Garnett spent weeks preparing for it, Garnett's military trial in the fall of 1862 was brief and inconclusive, interrupted forever by the war. No one who is familiar with the circumstances thought Jackson would have won. How then to interpret what would seem to almost any neutral observer an unfair, unforgiving, and vindictive attack on an honorable man? There are no easy answers. Richard Ewell later offered the least charitable interpretation possible. "If Kernstown had been a victory," he wrote, "there would have been no charges against Garnett." His meaning was unmistakable. Jackson was using Garnett as a scapegoat for their defeat. Whether that was true or not, his behavior during the war suggests that it was not, Jackson's quarrelsome streak certainly was more pronounced now that he had real power inside the Army's command structure. He had a tendency to find fault with others, especially with people he did not like, and this found expression in a series of public feuds with other officers, always over what Jackson perceived as a failure to perform duty, moral, military, or otherwise. He, of course, never cared what people thought of him, which made all of this somewhat worse. The prototype was his public fight with William H. French in Florida, where Jackson had shown a similar disregard for what his inflammatory, thinly supported charges could do to another man's life and reputation. There, too, it was difficult to imagine that somehow Jackson was doing this for his own advancement. In both cases, he seemed honestly committed to punishing what he considered to be the other man's transgression. That most men would have let such things pass was irrelevant to him. At VMI, he had feuded with Superintendent Francis H. Smith on several occasions. One disagreement was so serious that it led Jackson to resign as director of the Rockbridge Bible Society. Smith, it must be noted, was an ally, and an active one, who had tolerated Jackson's idiosyncrasies and defended him against charges of incompetence as a teacher. In the Romney campaign, Jackson had charged William Gillum, his friend, former business partner, and VMI colleague, with neglect of duty. Gillum, mercifully, had left the Army before Jackson could file the charges and specifications. Jackson had preferred charges against General William W. Loring for neglect of duty and conduct subversive of good order and military discipline. Fortunately, for all concerned, the War Department had shelved them. Not all of this censure was undeserved. Gillum, brilliant and popular as a professor, was a minor disaster as a field officer. Loring had set out almost from the beginning to subvert Jackson's authority, and had encouraged his officers in what amounted to an orchestrated campaign of insubordination in Richmond. In any case, this pattern would continue throughout the war. But none of Jackson's officers would suffer as much or as unfairly as Garnett. There was, however, a highly pragmatic lesson in all of this for anyone who served as a brigade commander under Stonewall Jackson. If you retreated without specific orders to do so, you would be arrested and brought up on charges, with the attendant destructive effects on your career and reputation. It is impossible to measure the effect of Jackson's action on the battlefields where his army fought. On the other hand, it is impossible to imagine that such a thought would not cross the mind of a brigadier who was thinking about ordering retreat. Garnett was not Jackson's only personnel problem. He had trouble, too, in his Valley campaign with the man who, besides Garnett, constituted his chief headache, Turner Ashby. In his case, though, the command structure offered the subordinate officer protection that the unfortunate Garnett did not have. Ashby and his cavalry were technically an independent command, receiving orders directly from the Confederate War Department, an arrangement that went back to the earliest days of the war and the formation of cavalry regiments. He was not untouchable, but he was harder to get at. He was also something that Garnett was not, a legend in the making, one of the Confederacy's very first, a dashing, charismatic, and astoundingly brave man who had the unswerving allegiance of his men in a way that Jackson's other officers did not. Jackson was well aware of all that. He was also aware of how demonically effective Ashby could be in the lethal margins between armies, screening Jackson's men, causing minor havoc for the enemy, blinding him, slowing him down. Ashby's legend was such that some federal prisoners said they believed he had magical powers. The evidence was that they had taken deadly aim at both horse and rider, and their bullets simply would not hit them. While no one could deny Ashby's bravery and reckless elan, however, he had glaring weaknesses as a field commander. He was, to begin, a poor disciplinarian who often had little or no control over his men. For the button-down, by-the-book Jackson, who insisted on unquestioning obedience to orders, Ashby was an administrative nightmare. On several occasions in April, he failed spectacularly to follow orders. Once, after neglecting to post guards, 60 of his men were caught asleep in church and taken prisoner. Later, as his men retreated from Mount Jackson, they failed to destroy supplies and equipment, including a large supply of military stores as well as 2 locomotives, a cardinal sin in Jackson's eyes. Still later, ordered to destroy bridges, they were instead found drunk on applejack in an old foundry. When the federal cavalry charged, they fled into the mountains. Sometimes Ashby's valor and incompetence merged. At Mount Jackson, he had intended to burn a bridge over the Shenandoah River to slow the enemy's advance, but his mounted unit got there only a few steps ahead of the Federals. As Jackson's staffer Henry Kidd Douglas described it, in a few minutes a heavy dust announced their approach. A regiment of cavalry in blue, with sabers glistening in the sun, came galloping in column of 4s into view, led apparently by an officer on a milk-white horse. It was beautiful. Distance lent enchantment to it. But soon the observers realized that the magnificent man on the white charger was really Ashby, who was actually being fired on by his pursuers. Ashby beat them to the bridge, where he tried to ignite a pile of combustibles that had been put there for that purpose. But he was too late. Federal cavalrymen were on him with drawn sabers. One shot from a horseman at his side cut into his boot, Douglas wrote, grazed his leg and buried itself in the side of his charger. The next moment the avenging sword of the master came down upon the enemy and rolled him in the dust. To us, watching far off, it was a moment of terrible anxiety. Not a word was spoken, not an exclamation. The bridge was not burned, but where was Ashby? Instantly he was seen to emerge from the bridge and follow his troops. Centaur-like, he and his horse came sweeping over the plain. They were soon with us. Moments later, Ashby's horse sank to the ground, mortally wounded, as Ashby stroked his mane and gazed into his eyes. Thus the most splendid horseman I ever knew lost the most beautiful war horse I ever saw, wrote Douglas. In spite of his picturesque bravery, Ashby had failed to burn a strategically critical bridge. Jackson had painfully mixed feelings about his brilliant, mercurial, unruly cavalry chief, a man he could not bend to his will. "Ashby never had his equal in a charge," Jackson later told his brother-in-law, D.H. Hill, in a moment of candor. "But he never had his men in hand, and some of his most brilliant exploits were performed by himself and a handful of followers. He was too kind-hearted to be a good disciplinarian." While he acknowledged Ashby's abilities to inspire men and his periodic effectiveness in repulsing disproportionate numbers of Union troops, he could not abide Ashby's lapses, some of which threatened the welfare of the larger army. The episode involving drunken troopers finally prompted him to act. On April 24, Jackson divided Ashby's force into two groups of 10 and 11 companies and reassigned them to two infantry brigades, effectively stripping him of his command. Ashby would still be able to control the advance and rear guards, but would have to apply to the infantry brigades for men to do it. Some of Ashby's loyal officers were even sympathetic to Jackson's attempt to impose order on this large and unmanageable group. There was still no regimental formation, and his large brigade with only two officers was an unwieldy body, said one of them. It was more like a tribal band held together by the authority of a single chief. Jackson saw the evil and tried to correct it. But Jackson had miscalculated. Ashby, furious, resigned, an act that shocked and depressed Jackson's entire command. "A great calamity has befallen us," wrote John Harmon to his brother. To him it was further proof that as sure as you and I live, Jackson is a cracked man, and the sequel will show it. The drama that played out next was unique in Jackson's career. Jackson asked Ashby to withdraw his resignation, as Jackson himself had done 2.5 months earlier. Ashby refused, and the two men exchanged angry words. Ashby came just short of threatening Jackson, asserting that but for the fact that he had the highest respect for Jackson's ability as a soldier and believed him central to the cause of the South, he would hold him to personal account for the indignity he had put upon him. Instead of digging in, however, Jackson decided that, as imperfect as his cavalry commander was, Ashby's resignation would cause far more harm than his remaining in command. Jackson thus, remarkably, backed down. He revoked his order. "If I persisted in my attempt to improve the efficiency of the cavalry," Jackson wrote candidly to Robert E. Lee on May 5, "it would produce the contrary effect, as Colonel Ashby's influence, who was very popular with his men, would be thrown against me." Ashby, reinstated, made a few meaningless promises to tighten discipline, and that was that. Jackson, a man who did not give up so easily, continued to quietly urge that the War Department take some sort of decisive action. Jackson's inflexible notions of duty also took a toll on his relationship with his talented, profane quartermaster, John Harmon. While the Army was at Rood's Hill, Jackson had granted Harmon a 48-hour furlough to return to his home in Stanton, where all five of his children were seriously ill with scarlet fever. When he arrived, two of them were already dead, and a third was in mortal danger. But when he asked Jackson to extend his leave, Jackson refused, and wrote him a letter explaining that duty trumped Harmon's family's troubles. A few days later, the third child died too, and Jackson refused Harmon's request to attend the funeral. Harmon was devastated, overcome with grief. Harmon would resign in mid-May, only to be talked out of it by Jackson, with promises of better treatment. Duty, in Jackson's army, was a hard master. In spite of his evident toughness, there were still soldiers in Jackson's army who believed they could challenge his authority. As the Army returned from Franklin to McDowell, Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Grigsby reported to Jackson that 17 members of the 27th Virginia, part of the Stonewall Brigade, who had volunteered to serve for 12 months, decided that since a year had passed, they were no longer bound to stay in the Army, even though the recent Confederate conscription law had frozen them in place. They had stacked their muskets and demanded to be discharged. Jackson's response to the news, eyes flashing, was, "What is this but mutiny? Why does Colonel Grigsby refer them to me to know what to do with a mutiny? He should shoot them where they stand. Jackson then issued orders to remedy the situation. The entire 27th Virginia Regiment, carrying loaded muskets, was assembled in a field. The 17 insubordinate soldiers were then marched in front of them and given a choice. They could either return to duty or be shot to death on the spot. They all chose, meekly, to return. This was the last attempt at organized disobedience in Jackson's army. Not all of Jackson's relationships with subordinates during the Valley campaign went badly. He had added the whip-smart, cocky Henry Kidd Douglas to his staff after Douglas proved his mettle on a perilous, all-night ride across the Blue Ridge Mountains to deliver a message to General Ewell. In addition, he hired a new assistant adjutant general, another term for chief of staff, named Robert Louis Dabney, a Presbyterian pastor who was also one of the leading Presbyterian scholars in the nation. Dabney also happened to be married to one of Anna's cousins. As a chief of staff, he was dismissed by the rest of the staff as only marginally competent, an impression he did not improve by shading himself with an umbrella while on horseback, which elicited jeers from the troops. But Jackson liked and respected him, and especially liked his sermons. And anyway, his young aide, Sandy Pendleton, ended up doing most of the routine adjutant work. After Kernstown, Jackson had also added to his staff the remarkable Jedediah Hotchkiss, a man who would play a large role in Jackson's success. Hotchkiss, 33, was from Stanton. He was one of Virginia's leading geologists and an accomplished amateur cartographer. He was devoutly religious and neither drank alcohol nor smoked. Jackson summoned him, asked him about the topographical work he had done in Virginia, and then gave him his first order. "I want you to make me a map of the valley from Harper's Ferry to Lexington, showing all points of offense and defense in those places. Mr. Pendleton will give you orders for whatever outfit you want. Good morning, sir." At a time when many commanders were forced to use store-bought maps of atrocious quality, Hotchkiss was an extraordinary asset. Jackson had already used his talents in crossing the Blue Ridge and in the mountainous country around McDowell. His ability to understand and employ terrain would have everything to do with Jackson's next enterprise, the destruction of Nathaniel Prentiss Banks. Chapter 25, Hunter as Prey. Major General Richard S. Ewell, the man they called Old Baldhead, was in a blazing rage. He was so angry, stalking back and forth in his quarters with his spurs on and his cap drawn low on his hairless pate, that his staff, at whom he had blown up several times that day, was studiously avoiding him. The date was May 13, 1862, 5 days after the Battle of McDowell. The object of his fury was none other than his fellow general, Thomas J. Jackson, who had abandoned him precipitously at this muddy camp in the Elk Run Valley near Swift Run Gap 10 days before. Jackson had told him almost nothing of his plans and had left him to languish in what Ewell considered a godforsaken hole ever since. Ewell had learned of the victory at McDowell only to be informed that Jackson was embarking on what Ewell considered the deeply misguided pursuit of Schenck and Milroy up the mountain-walled south branch of the Potomac River. Ewell, meanwhile, had been left to stew in his own sour air, to fend off constant annoying wires from Richmond, asking him questions he could not answer, and to rage at Jackson. "Did it ever occur to you that General Jackson is crazy?" he asked the unfortunate Colonel James A. Walker, who had tried to avoid such an interrogation. This was the same James A. Walker who, as a cadet at VMI, had challenged Jackson in his classroom, threatened him, and later been expelled. "I don't know, General," Walker replied. "We used to call him Tom Fool Jackson at the Institute, but I don't suppose he is really crazy." "I tell you, sir, he is as crazy as a March hare," stormed Ewell. "He has left me here with some instructions to stay until he returns, but Banks's whole army is advancing on me, and I haven't even the remotest idea where to communicate with General Jackson. I tell you, sir, he is crazy." The source of Ewell's anger was news that Union General James Shields had detached his force from Banks and was marching with a full division through New Market Gap, across the Massanutten Mountain, northward up the Luray Valley, and over the Blue Ridge, on his way to join McDowell at Fredericksburg. Shields, in other words, was passing directly under Ewell's nose, and there was nothing Ewell could do about it, and he simply couldn't stand it. Powerless to attack, he did the only thing he could. He dispatched part of the 6th Virginia Cavalry and several pieces of horse artillery under VMI graduate Tom Munford to impede Shields' movement in every possible way. When Munford stopped by Ewell's quarters at midnight to check in before leaving, the latter was still so agitated that he leaped out of bed and, wearing only his nightshirt, went down on his knees on the raw floor and spread out a map under the light of a large burning lamp. His bones fairly rattled, Munford recalled. His bald head and long beard made him look more like a witch than a major general. He became much excited, pointed out Jackson's position, General Shields's and General Banks's. Then, with an ugly oath, he said, "This great wagon hunter is after a Dutchman, an old fool." He was referring to General Robert Schenck's Dutch ancestry and to Jackson's keen interest in capturing federal supplies. "Why, I could crush Shields before night if I could move from here," he went on. "This man Jackson is certainly a crazy fool, an idiot." And with that, Ewell showed Munford the brief, tersely worded wire he had received from Jackson. "Your dispatch received. Hold your position. Don't move. I have driven General Milroy from McDowell. Through God's assistance, have captured most of his wagon train." Ewell jumped to his feet, utterly exasperated, and asked incredulously, "What has Providence to do with Milroy's wagon train?" While Ewell fumed in his quarters, Jackson was already pushing his army hard, southward, back down the road they had taken from Stanton to Franklin. He was headed back to the valley as fast as he could go. He would not keep Ewell in the dark long. Ewell was the key to everything. Without his 8,000 men, Jackson could not even think about attacking Banks. That same day, May 13, Jackson sent Ewell a wire telling him he was coming back and ordering him to follow Banks if he moved farther north. Ewell would not get this until the next day, hence his rage at being neglected. On May 15, 6 days after the battle, Jackson's troops had passed over the last high ridges of the Alleghenies and descended back into the valley, which, in their absence, had finally burst into glorious spring. "The old valley looked like paradise," recalled an artillerist. "Cherry and peach trees were loaded with blooms, the fields covered with rank clover." 2 days later, Jackson turned off the McDowell-Stanton Road. His army wheeled and headed north toward Harrisonburg and Banks's camps in the heart of the valley. Jackson was now fully aware of Shields's departure, which meant that Banks was suddenly and unquestionably vulnerable. Jackson had been more than willing to move against Banks's two divisions with his own two smaller divisions. Now the numbers had swung wildly in his favor. The effect was like placing raw meat in front of a wolf. 2 days before, Jackson had received a wire from Lee's adjutant, advising him of Lee's steadfast belief that if you can form a junction with General Ewell with your combined forces, you would be able to drive Banks from the valley. The phrase had a nice feel to it. It meant that the hated invaders would be thrown back, clear across the Potomac. With Lee's blessing, Jackson now thought only of striking Banks. For the moment, nothing else mattered. What he had in mind was not going to be easy. His main problem lay not in the valley proper, but in the eastern suburbs of Richmond. McClellan's enormous army, advance units of which now camped 6 miles from the city, was the Confederacy's main concern. Shields' reinforcements of McDowell would give the latter some 40,000 troops, who Jefferson Davis and his War Department brain trust assumed were headed toward Richmond. They were right. Unbeknownst to them, the order to move upon Richmond had been received by Urban McDowell on May 17. The valley, in other words, looked again like the minor sideshow it was. Ewell was more urgently needed east of the Blue Ridge. So probably was Jackson. In spite of Lee's standing orders, Jackson might be pulled from the valley at any moment. While Jackson was on the road north, approaching Harrisonburg, Ewell received orders, written several days earlier, from Joe Johnston that seemed to defeat all of Jackson's plans. Should Banks cross the Blue Ridge to join General McDowell at Fredericksburg, Johnston wrote, General Jackson and yourself should move eastward rapidly to join either the army at Fredericksburg, commanded by Brigadier General J.R. Anderson, or this one. Half of Banks's army had already crossed the Blue Ridge. Johnston's wire put Ewell, who wanted as much as Jackson to attack Banks, in a mild panic. Seeing no other way to solve his dilemma, and impatient with couriers, Ewell mounted his horse and rode 50 miles, crossing the Luray Valley, the swollen South Fork of the Shenandoah, and the Massanutten Mountain at New Market Gap. He rode all night, reaching Jackson's camp near Harrisonburg at daybreak on May 18. When he arrived, he refused breakfast and sat down in an old clapboard mill to discuss business with Jackson, a man whose sanity he had recently wondered about. The two men found much common ground, and soon came upon an elegantly deceptive solution, one that used Joe Johnston's somewhat paranoid insistence on using couriers alone, instead of couriers plus telegraph, against him. Ewell, again, was the key. In spite of his quick temper, he was ordinarily the model of a good soldier, following orders and rarely challenging authority. But in this case, he asserted himself. He would stay with Jackson in the valley and continue the campaign against Banks. As long as Jackson took responsibility for what happened, he would agree to join their forces. He would, in effect, defy Johnston's orders. But the two conspirators needed some sort of official cover, so they decided to make up their own. The day before, Jackson had sent a message to Johnston asking for new orders, based on Banks's shift to Strasburg and Shields's transit eastward, that would allow him to attack Banks. Because of Johnston's insistence on using couriers, Jackson would not get his answer for 3 days. In the meantime, he and Ewell needed a reason for not obeying Johnston's order. Sitting in the old mill, Ewell wrote a note to Jackson, bearing a false date line from Columbia Bridge in the Luray Valley, as though he had never made his midnight ride. He blandly described his predicament, told of the news of Shields' departure, and updated Jackson on the status of his army. Jackson then wrote out an equally flat response, purporting to remind Ewell that as you are in the Valley District, you constitute part of my command, and requesting that should you receive orders different from those sent from these headquarters, please advise me of the same at as early a period as practicable. They were covered, at least for a while. Then they made a simple plan. Ewell's army would cross at New Market Gap 3 days later, and together they would drive north along the Valley Pike and assault Banks head-on at Strasburg. Their business concluded, Jackson and Ewell breakfasted amiably together, and the two attended Sunday services at the camp of the 12th Georgia Regiment, where the new chief of staff, the theologian and minister Robert L. Dabney, gave the sermon. Then Old Bald Head, who had not slept in 24 hours, mounted up and rode away. Jackson and Ewell both put their armies on the road early the next morning, heading for their rendezvous in New Market. Everything was going as planned. Unfortunately, they were not yet free of interference. On May 20, just as Ewell and his 8,000 men were cresting the top of New Market Gap, heading down toward the Valley Pike, came the worst possible news. In a dispatch written 3 days earlier, Johnston had ordered Ewell outright, without any contingencies or allowance for discretion, to cross the Blue Ridge and join General Richard Anderson's division. There was no wiggle room this time. If Banks is fortifying near Strasburg, wrote Johnston, the attack would be too hazardous. Ewell, shaken by the news, again rode to Jackson's camp, a far shorter distance this time. General Ewell, I am glad to see you, said Jackson warmly as Ewell rode up. You will not be so glad when I tell you what has brought me. What, are the Yankees after you? Worse than that, Ewell replied. I am ordered to join General Johnston. Considering what a stickler he was for regulations and army protocols, what Jackson did next was extraordinary. His clear duty was to release Ewell, but with Banks finally in his sights, he could not bring himself to do it. Bypassing Johnston and the normal chain of command, Jackson now appealed by telegraph directly to his new ally, Robert E. Lee. I am of the opinion that an attack should be made to defeat Banks, he wrote. But under instructions just received from General Johnston, I do not feel at liberty to make an attack. Please answer by telegraph. He dispatched a courier who galloped off to Stanton, 40 miles away, from which point the telegram would be sent to Richmond. Now Jackson committed what amounted to an open act of insubordination. On Johnston's order to Ewell, he scribbled his own counter-order, directing Ewell to suspend the execution of the order for returning to the East until I receive an answer to my telegram. It was the sort of act for which Jackson would automatically have court-martialed one of his own officers. Ewell, who was still gamely playing along, had to wonder what might come of such a breach of the chain of command. But he stood firm. Fortunately, the crisis resolved itself quickly. That evening, a courier delivered a 2-day-old message from Johnston, telling Ewell that he and Jackson were at liberty to attack Banks, supposing your strength sufficient. Johnston was not taking a hard line after all. A subsequent message reminded them that their goal was the prevention of the junction of General Banks's troops with those of General McDowell. Lee, too, soon added his approval. Though they left no record of it, the two major generals, who had flirted with insubordination and had suddenly become close collaborators, must have been thrilled. They immediately concocted a daring variation on their original plan. Instead of marching due north up the Valley Pike, Jackson would throw out a cavalry screen north of New Market, then turn eastward, and along with Ewell, pass through the Massanutten to the Luray Valley. Their armies would march north together, concealed by the looming mountain, seize the town of Front Royal with its small Union garrison, then fall on Banks's flank, either destroying him or forcing him to withdraw toward the Potomac to protect his lines of supply and communication. Success depended once again on speed and deception, qualities that residents of the Shenandoah Valley were beginning to associate with Thomas Jackson. In many ways, Nathaniel Banks was not a bad general, certainly nowhere near the outright disaster that many of the purely political generals on both sides turned out to be. Though he had no army experience, the former Massachusetts governor and Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives had learned military ways quickly. He had paid attention. He had a marked talent for administration. He was good at handling the physical army, competent at supply and logistics, and did not lack nerve. His men liked and admired him. Where he fell woefully short was in strategic maneuver. Though he managed to get the details right, somehow, almost inevitably, he got the big picture wrong. Banks had dragged his army back, reluctantly and disconsolately, to Strasburg. He and his senior officers felt only bitterness that they had allowed Jackson to escape, only to defeat Milroy and Schenck, and that they were executing a retrograde march after such an inspiring entree into the valley. Most of all, having been stripped of Shields' division and stuck in a lonely outpost in a theater of war that contained mystically elusive Stonewall Jackson, they were suddenly unaccountably vulnerable. Here we are, with a greatly reduced force, either used as a decoy for the rebel forces or for some unaccountable purpose known only to the War Department. Alpheus Williams, the commander of the only infantry division remaining to Banks, wrote on May 17. The worst part is that we put ourselves in a most critical position and exposed the whole of this important valley to be retaken and its immense property of railroads and stores to be destroyed. Williams was right. With 5,000 men at Strasburg and 1,000 at Front Royal, Banks was in peril from any number of directions. As he put it, their orders from Stanton obliged him unreasonably to hold the debauches of two valleys 12 miles apart. On May 22, Banks issued what amounted to a cry for help. The return of the rebel forces of General Jackson after his forced march against Generals Milroy and Schenck increases my anxiety for the safety of the position I occupy, he wrote Stanton. I am compelled to believe that he meditates attack here. In his bitterness, Banks had somehow forgotten the reason for his predicament. His own multiple messages to the War Department, trumpeting the departure of Jackson's pathetic and broken forces from the valley, never to return. Banks had sold the idea too well. He had succeeded, now that he could finally see it clearly, only in isolating himself with an aggressive enemy in a theater of war that the enemy knew better than he did. All Banks could do was blame someone else, which is exactly what he did. His woes were the fault of General Irvin McDowell, he concluded, who in his greed, cowardice, and jealousy had managed to amass 40,000 men who did nothing more than sit idly about in their camps in Fredericksburg, protecting Washington from phantom armies. It had taken Banks some time to see the big picture clearly, but now it was in sharp focus. He believed that Jackson and Ewell were going to attack him. He was absolutely right. But whatever Secretary of War Stanton may have thought of Banks's urgent wire, it was too late to do anything about it. With full, enthusiastic approval from Richmond, Jackson now began his move against Banks. His men left in the early morning, having deposited all unnecessary equipment, which included knapsacks and tents, at the Rockingham County Courthouse. At the same moment Banks was issuing his dire warning, Jackson and Ewell, who had crossed from the Shenandoah into the Luray Valley the day before, were fulfilling his worst nightmare. He could not see them, of course. He had, in fact, no idea that Jackson was as close as he was, or that he was even in the valley at all. Though his information was hazy at best, Banks assumed Jackson was still in the vicinity of Franklin or McDowell, and that Ewell had remained at Swift Run Gap, waiting for Jackson. Part of this was the sheer speed of Jackson's march, which defied all of the Union command's seemingly rational assumptions about what an army could do, or how fast and far it could move. From May 3, the day Jackson crossed the Blue Ridge on his detour to Stanton, to May 22, his army, with all its equipment and ponderous supply trains, had marched more than 200 miles through what were mostly abysmal conditions, often with short rations, inadequate supplies, and without such amenities as tents or shoes, crossing mountain ranges, roaring streams, and sodden valleys. One of Jackson's artillerymen wrote his mother that he had been marching 23 days straight with only 3 days of rest. And now, exhausted and used up as they were, he was marching them again. Part of Jackson's invisibility was a result of Ashby's devastatingly effective cavalry screen, which kept the entire Union command in the dark about Jackson's movements. Jackson had thrown it out to help cover his move across Banks' front at Stanton. When Banks retreated to Strasburg, Ashby followed, fanning out his troopers in a wide arc extending to Banks's pickets, who were posted as far south as Woodstock. Jackson explained this in a later report. To conceal my movements as far as possible from the enemy, Brigadier General Ashby, who had remained in front of Banks during the march against Milroy, was directed to continue to hold that position until the following day, May 21, when he was to join the main body, leaving, however, a covering force sufficient to prevent information of our movements crossing our lines. While Banks sat nervously in Strasburg, utterly blind and figuring that whatever was coming at him would be both visible and headed north along the valley pike, Jackson was actually marching up the Luray Valley, behind a screen that was a combination of Ashby's hyper-aggressive troopers and the impenetrable wall of the Massanutten, toward the Union garrison at Front Royal. Chapter 26. The Professor's Time-Speed-Distance Equation. In the lazy late afternoon of May 23, 1862, in the Strasburg camps of General Nathaniel Prentiss Banks, it seemed as though the world had gone to sleep. The air was still and hot, the canvas tents were stifling. There was little movement anywhere, and whatever moved did so very slowly. For many of these Union soldiers, there was a feeling that the war was about to end without them, that they had missed out on whatever glory they might have secured for themselves with McClellan at Richmond. Now they seemed destined to finish their service in this lovely, irrelevant place. Though some were disappointed, most had gotten more than their fill of soldiering, with its rotten salt pork, weevily hardtack, and muddy bivouacs. They were relaxed and ready for the fighting to stop. A general languor was manifested in the drowsy way in which the sentinels dawdled along their posts, recalled Banks's subordinate Colonel George H. Gordon, or in the aimless, sleepy air in which the troops addressed themselves to such amusements as were suggested by time and place. Colonel Gordon himself was doing nothing in particular. Just after 4 p.m., the stillness was broken by the sound of galloping hooves, followed by the appearance of Corporal Charles H. Greenleaf of Company D, 5th New York Cavalry, at Banks's headquarters. He was exhausted. He had just ridden 17 miles in less than an hour from Front Loyal to Strasburg in the simmering heat, taking a detour to dodge rebel horsemen. He had come to report that a Confederate force of indeterminate size had attacked the Union troops there under Colonel John R. Kenly. Greenleaf had been sent on an urgent mission to request reinforcements for the Union regiment stationed in Front Royal. General Banks listened. He was not terribly upset by what he heard. After all, cavalry and horse artillery attacks by Ashby's ubiquitous troopers had become commonplace. But as the afternoon faded into evening, other reports began to pile up at Banks's headquarters, each one adding more and more alarming detail about these inexplicable events in Front Royal. Shortly after dark, an escaped slave reported that Colonel Kenly was in full retreat. Later came a note from a captain of the 1st Maryland Cavalry, saying that Kenley's regiment had been destroyed, that he had been killed, and all his field officers and surgeons captured, and that Stonewall Jackson was marching on Winchester with 20,000 men. Another cavalry officer reported that he had been attacked by 300 or 400 cavalry and some infantry. Even these accounts did not upset General Banks terribly. They all seemed a bit hysterical, delivered by scared men who had likely fled whatever fighting was taking place. Owing to what was deemed an extravagant statement of the enemy's strength, Banks wrote, as though yawning while he wrote the words, these reports were received with some distrust. His aide, David Hunter Strother, put it more bluntly. After hearing the apparently tall tale of Jackson and 20,000 men, he remarked to Banks that this fellow was some coward who had ingloriously fled the field and covered his ignominy by monstrous lying. In spite of his skepticism, Banks dispatched a regiment of infantry, along with some cavalry, to Front Royal. But the news kept rolling in. Throughout the evening, telegrams arrived from Winchester, relaying information from various refugees, soldiers, teamsters, sutlers, and cavalrymen, that Front Royal had fallen to a force of Confederates, variously estimated at 15,000 to 20,000. At about midnight, yet another officer reported that his unit had been destroyed and that he had seen a rebel force of 5,000 or 6,000 fall back on Front Royal. By this point, it was clear that something had happened out on the foggy perimeters, and that it had involved more than just a few companies of men. Amazingly, it was not until 10 p.m. that Banks took any of this seriously. And it was midnight, 10 hours after the initial attack, before he fully acknowledged that something disastrous had occurred on his flank, a mere 12 miles away. By the time he went to bed, sometime after 1 a.m., he had come to accept, finally, that his worst fears had been realized, and much faster than he had ever dreamed possible. He and his staff now agreed, conceded might be a better word, that Ewell was at Front Royal, and that the shadowy Jackson was very likely moving northward toward them along the turnpike. The extraordinary force of the enemy could no longer be doubted, wrote Banks later. It was apparent also that they had a more extended purpose than the capture of the brave little band at Front Royal. This purpose could be nothing less than the defeat of my own command. He was used to being the hunter. He now understood that he was being hunted. He did not yet understand, and would have been far more upset had he realized, that the principal hunter, Jackson, in person and accompanied by the veteran army that had defeated Schenck and Milroy at McDowell, was also on his doorstep at Front Royal. Anticipating the worst, Banks got his wagon trains rolling late that night toward Winchester, which also happened to be in the direction of Maryland, safety, and home. At 7 o'clock in the morning that very same day, May 23, under the same hot sun and fair skies, some 75 miles to the east, President Abraham Lincoln and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton stepped from a steamboat onto a dock on the Potomac River. The place was Aquia Landing, a federal logistical and supply depot less than 10 miles by rail from the town of Fredericksburg. The two men had traveled all night from Washington to get there. It was a happy occasion. They had come to meet personally with General Irvin McDowell and to review his Army of the Rappahannock, all in anticipation of the big assault on Richmond. In spite of McClellan's dithering, Union prospects had never been sunnier, and Lincoln knew it. The Union victory at Shiloh and the seizure of New Orleans were fresh memories, as were the even more recent victories by McClellan at Yorktown, May 3, and Williamsburg, May 6. In the last 2 months, McClellan had managed to haul his sprawling army up the soggy, brush-choked peninsula to the gates of Richmond. Confederates had evacuated Norfolk and its shipyards on May 9 and were forced to scuttle their prize ironclad warship, Virginia, formerly the Merrimack, on May 11. Admiral David Farragut's warships were steaming north toward Vicksburg, Mississippi, after capturing New Orleans, in a strategic thrust that would likely secure northern control over the entire Mississippi River. And Union forces under John Pope and Andrew H. Foote had cleared the upper Mississippi nearly to Memphis with the capture of Island No. 10. With the arrival of General James Shields' division from the valley, McDowell's army, which he paraded grandly that day before Lincoln and Stanton, was now 40,000 men and 86 cannon strong. It was almost as big as the entire Confederate force that had opposed McClellan on the peninsula. 3 days hence, under Lincoln's orders, McDowell was to advance toward Richmond. There was no one in the Union camp that day, or in the War Department in Washington, who believed that with 150,000 to 160,000 men attacking the Confederate capital from two directions, they could fail to take the city. All the big logistical questions had been settled. What could possibly go wrong? While Lincoln and Stanton were making plans with McDowell at Fredericksburg, and Banks's men were idling in the languid sunshine at Strasburg, Jackson and Ewell were pushing their soldiers as fast as they could down the Luray Valley toward Front Royal and the small Union garrison there. Their column stretched for 12 miles. They had started at dawn, marching 4 abreast down the river road, following the course of the South Fork of the Shenandoah, in the shadow of the long humped ridges of Massanutten Mountain on the west and the soaring Blue Ridge on the east. The Luray Valley was a miniature of the Shenandoah, and just as lovely. Jackson and Ewell rode with the vanguard. Jackson's division was the Old Valley Army, all Virginians, most of them local. It held 3 brigades under Brigadier Generals Charles S. Winder and William B. Taillefer, and Colonel John A. Campbell. Ewell's division was a much more representative unit of the Confederacy, containing regiments from Maryland, Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama. They were organized into 4 brigades under Brigadier Generals Arnold Elzey, Isaac Trimble, and Richard Taylor, and Colonel William C. Scott. The Army's cavalries were commanded by Virginians, Brigadier General Turner Ashby and Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Flournoy. Colonel Stapleton Crutchfield, a former Jackson student at VMI, was in charge of artillery. Just how many men Jackson actually had in his command as he marched on Front Royal is harder to say. Civil War troop strength is a notoriously muddy statistic, and the paper returns of an army often bore no resemblance to the size of the force a commander could deploy on a battlefield. Jackson in the Valley offers a classic example. On May 3, he claimed 8,597 infantry. This number reflected huge growth since the Battle of Kernstown 6 weeks before, mostly in the form of new recruits who were anticipating being drafted. This probably seemed to the Confederate High Command to be very good news. It wasn't, really. In the next 3 weeks, the Valley Army suffered from what amounted to mass desertion and mass straggling. Often it was hard to tell the difference between the